If you want the norm of that vector, the customer norm of that vector, we now recognize that it's null, but we want to know how you get it in general. But what you do is you take the difference between these two as measured along the generators. And that's going to be some function of distance depending on the generator you're on. And then to get the norm, you take 1 over the square of that and integrate it over a two-sphere, so two-sphere integral corresponding to the lower or the one around the cusp. We're integrating that distance over the cusp, we don't have to square it. And then we take 1 over that one, and it turns out that is just constant at all. So this is the picture that we have of the flat space. You can get the asymptotic projection. Twister space, you can represent the Minkowski space of points in terms of these specified cuts, and then you have this expression for the vector. Well, then what we want to do is carry that over, see how much of that carries over to the third space. Whereabouts is yours, George?
It's on the outside.
So, okay, so then what carries over to an asymptotically flat space time, which corresponds to some isolated source radiating away. Well, the definition of an isolated source can be taken to be the existence of the described dust. So, your asymptotically flat space-time is going to have described dust. It won't be going to have this point at the top here, or a point down at the bottom, but we'll have this point of it. And we'll similarly have the sort of cube picture again, where we can classify. Okay. The coordinates on here as before, the difference that you have now is that the surface is a constant u, going around like that. If you run those back in as hypersurfaces, these will have some shear associated with them already, which is a measure of the, which determines the radiation field in here. In fact, the components of the radiation field, the psi 3 and psi 4, something straight away in terms of signal. One is F3 signal dot, and one is signal double dot. F is just an angle of different object, and it's sent to be like beta. Maybe that's a mark here. So the sigma is determining the radiation field, and so that information is given to you. Now you want to try and reproduce as much of that as possible. So what you do is try and find cut up here, say it's given as function procedure filter, and you want this cut to be shear free in the sense that if you take the hypersurface going back and it's got vanishing asymptotic shear. Well, the condition for this cut to be shear free expressed in terms of this, which is the cut, the shear of the cosmic new surfaces, is x squared z has to be equal to sigma naught z is equal to that. And n here is essentially g2 zeta squared. Okay. So the picture that came over here was the asymptotically shear-free cuts. It was a four complex parameter family of them, corresponding to the four complex parameter family of points in the next line of the Gaussian space. But in particular, there was a four real parameter family of them corresponding to the real points. And over here, when it comes to trying to solve this equation, sigma naught is a complex function So there's no hope, in general, of finding a real shared which satisfies this equation. So here, this equation is necessarily complex. You can't expect to find any real root cusps. The question is, can you even expect to find complex root cusps because it's got a nasty nonlinear equation? And the answer is you can. You are always guaranteed, providing simple root cusps can be, you are always guaranteed to form complex grand family of them. And this is proved by Penrose on the basis of various perturbation theorems. So you do have four grand family of these root cusps. Now they're necessarily complex. And these are the points of the H case. There's the raw one for me. They're not in any sense flat anymore. And these are the points of the H curve. So there's H. Going down here. This is going to be the H base. And the point of the H base is one of these good cuts. Now the complex geodesics, which lay in the cross the Z field plane over there, will then go to this over here. This is going to have geodesics lying on it in this direction. And these are going to be the points of the projected crystal space. Using the curling tool that Richard used just now. So these purple things are going to be points of the projected crystal space. And now this won't be ruled by geodesics going the other way. So that's the H base of the projected crystal space. You can see the structure of the projected crystal space. It's still got its same vibration as before, but it's lost all the linear structure it had over there. So it's not going to have it all, but it's more got more structure to it than it used to have over there. Now the definition. Right. Now you want to get definitions of metric and such like on this H space in terms of the picture that we have here. Well, for definition of conformal metric, you can try the same thing again. That green surface, which is one of these root cusps, that's this line over here. And you can take two of these root cusps. So this is another one. Take two of these good cuts, we now separate if they meet over here, and that comes down to having a purple line in common again. And that's the definition that Richard mentioned for the conformal metric. But what about the full metric? Well, to get the full metric, you can always try this thing again that worked before, 1 over the square of the distance of the generators. So to get the full metric, you're taking the distance between these two and integrate 1 over the square root. And if you do that, you want to integrate the integral of b squared. You have to be more careful about contours this time. It isn't just simply a sphere contour. Because before, if I had a real sphere going around to integrate over, this is more complicated, you have to be careful about the contours. Nonetheless, if you do it, sure enough, it comes out to be quadratic. Let's see. It was a four parameter set of these good cuts. So let's suppose this one corresponds to the value of ZA of the parameters, and this one to ZA plus BZA of the parameters. Then this thing indeed comes out to be quadratic. So you do have a quadratic metric on the H space. So you can then proceed to work out the curvature. And if you do that, the curvature comes out to be self-dual. So that the dual of the ring tensor is this is self-dual, it's the same historical axis that I was using the answer to twist over there. This is self-dual, so that in particular, that's why it's the Einstein equation. So this H brace comes out automatically from this construction, that definition is symmetric, satisfying the Einstein equation. Now you can give a geometric construction of the metric, not involving this integral, and that's what Richard alluded to earlier on. So, okay, the picture that you've got is radiating space-time. You take the radiation field, determined by sigma, from it you get a curve twist of space, and you get one of these things. This is actually left flat, rather than right flat. A left flat space-time algorithm. Now this is, again, this is necessarily complex. It won't have any real sections with the red signature, or even that red signature like that. It could have positive definite sections, or it could have sort of half and half sections, on which the metric is real. Once again, it won't be general, but it's definitely not going to have any of these, since the metric is real. So what is this H-base? What does this construction mean? Well, the picture that we have of it is this method of taking the original radiating space-time and projecting out from it the self-dual part of the radiation. So you're taking what's essentially non-linear equations, the Einstein equations, and you're breaking it into the longitudinal transverse part, and half the longitudinal part is going out here as a self-dual radiation field. If I started instead with the complex conjugate of sigma, and analytically extended that, so I was dealing with sigma tilde, I would come down to an H tilde space, which would have been right flat or anti-self-dual, and these two constructions would have been projecting out the self-dual part of the radiation field and the anti-self-dual part of the radiation field. Well, to justify the assertion that that is projection, what you need to be sure of is that if you take a space-time, work out its H-base, and then work out the H-base of that H-base, you get the same thing again. And if you take a space-time, work out its H-base, and work out the H-tilde space of that, then you get nothing, where nothing means flat space in this sense. True, and in fact these things do turn out to be true, with certain proviso is, of course, once you've worked out the H-base, you must be able to do the H-base construction too. So in other words, once you've worked out the H-base, it must be absolutely flat itself, otherwise you can't do that construction. With that proviso, this is true, so this projection is appropriate. You can say, well, let me just say a brief word about so what you might try and do with it is the following. You've now got this picture of radiation fields, or these self-dual radiation fields. Well, these correspond to possible sigmas, which in turn are corresponding to curved twist spaces. And so Roger's suggestion that the curved twist spaces be regarded as non-particle states in a theory of gravity, that means that the sigmas, the space of possible sigmas, have this sort of property as well. You could ask, well, which of these radiation fields are absolutely flat? Okay. We want these to be asymptotically flat, roughly going to correspond to normal eigenspace. What's that going to mean? Well, what that seems to mean is that sigma naught is supposed to fall off at large values of u. That's reasonable. So maybe not sigma naught, maybe what we want is as you go a long way up to the answer part. And that's the reason. Which ones of these are positive frequency. And once again, in a curved space, it's a little bit difficult to say what we mean by positive frequency, but one good suggestion is that the signal itself is positive frequency. When you do a Fourier analysis of it in terms of that new parameter. Now, the other thing is, what about the scalar product between these different states? Well, you can find a nice simple expression in terms of the two sigmas for a scalar product. So all that's the same. That's the examples of expressions. We're up to many because this rather horrendous nonlinear equation. Well, actually, solving this is pretty hard. It's a second order nonlinear equation. Yeah. We'll do that, I think. The hard part is all this is telling you is the zeta dependence is there. What you need to know as well is the zeta tilde dependence. And that is fixed by the fact that you want this z to represent a good cut when you go all the way around. So the zeta tilde is fixed rather implicitly in there. Consequently, it gets rather hard to solve this equation. There are a few examples lying around, some of which George Farley's found. And in those two, in those examples, I also say something about what happens to the transverse parts of the field. Well, roughly the transverse parts of the field. Is it the wrong way around? Okay. I was going to say, I said that. But I was going to say something about the longitudinal part. And the longitudinal part has to do with the momentum and angular momentum of the source. Well, one thing you can do with those, which I've learned from this guy, following on similar work from Newman, is that you can use the other bits, that's the psi 2, psi by 1, to associate momentum and angular momentum with various different cuts. And they then appear as spinner fields and vector fields on the H space. And you can discuss the equations of motion of the source in terms of how this momentum and angular momentum behave on the H space. And that's what's happened to the longitudinal. The other thing. Okay, that's what I was going to say.
Enough. Yeah, I'll build up some of the predictions in it. I'm very certain actually. I'll say at the beginning, it will have nothing to do very much with that on predictions. It will just be about general structure of market and mass and profits from a certain point of view. One of the things about physics is that discrete symmetry favors the large rho. The very simple discrete symmetries, which were originally believed to hold, like parity, time reversal, charge conjugation, the whole works, they were all originally thought to be good and solid, and then eventually parity went. Then time reversal, if you assume CPT, suddenly CP. And if people like Roger are right, CPT is going to go as well. People like Stephen Hawking are right, baryon number is going to go down the drain, as well as lepton number. Virtually nothing is actually conserved, I mean, it gets down to the ground detail. But usually there are some aspects of physics where things are conserved. Parity seems to be good for the graviton, there's possibly none for that, and similarly for the photon. Another example of discrete symmetry is in the name of certain gauge theories. Like the Weinberg-Salam theory is exactly the same as the Salam-Weinberg theory. That's very simple. Discrete symmetry applies exactly to the weak interaction theory. If you try and extend it to the Hadron theory, it breaks down immediately because Salam isolates quarks to be liberated, whereas Weinberg does not. Okay, so that's the best one. Anyway, the basic symmetry I'm interested in is the business relation between muons and electrons, which isn't treated by the Salam-Weinberg or Weinberg-Salam theory. Before I get down to those sort of things, I just want to go through certain things about the conformal group. One of the questions of interest is whether the conformal group represents any role to play in the description of mass and properties. And my feeling is yes. How does this thing go on? Basically, how unphysical is it? What's wrong with the conformal group? Why haven't people used it systematically previously? And have they been misled? To remind you what conformal group is, actually I'll stick mostly with the conformal generators. It's basically been around the whole of the day, and it hasn't really been mentioned very much. We have various generators for the conformal group, the momentum, the angular momentum, and dilations. The momentum and angular momentum are basically just the primary part of the conformal group. The dilations, if you throw them, they give you the Poincaré group plus dilations, the point is that it is a group. And then the last thing, what we have to mention is 2. The momentum is 4, the angular momentum is 6. It's cubed, 2 in its tensor, hard to mention these things. The dilations is just one real dimension. And then also, the special thing that the extra things that the conformal group have are the generators of special conformal, special conformal transformation, which you can think of as being a transformation which is given by inverting with respect to the origin, making a translation, and which translation depends on basically what component, the cube you're using, and then making another inversion in the origin. Rather complicated transformation which requires compactifying the Kossky state in a way carried out by people like Morita in order to describe it satisfactorily. At the global level, not even in general. If these things as quantum operators describing a system, you have a whole slew of computation relations. Most of them are pretty trivial. Usual things, momentum creates with itself. This formula here, which is typical of the sort of formula we find for any vector operator, just tells you that the momentum p is in fact a 4 vector. Then this essentially tells you that m is in fact a skewed to index tensor, and similarly the q is a 4 vector, that equation. This is a rather grubby one, which is a rather hard thing to understand. Q creates with q, it's a translation essentially. The main business in it is which direction you chose to translate after you your inversion. And then these things, the D is just telling you basically the dimensionality of the various things that are in your theory, like, for instance, the momentum in you can choose different definitions, as you can choose the momentum scale for the language, and this sort of thing scales with plus. Now, for my purposes, if you count dimensions here, you've got 15 ingredients altogether. I propose you have 16, which is divided by 4. I'm going to throw in an extra nuance of symmetry, which I can do. And let's just assume we have it. I'm just going to make sure it was agrees with everything. So this isn't going to carry any non-trivial information. This is the first slide. With those ingredients, then they make several definitions. These basically are designed to simplify the problem, simplify one's understanding. Firstly, the usual definition of a mass, just the square of the momentum, the mass squared. Then Roger mentioned this, the Pauli mass and spin vector. That's the thing which normally you talk about in the rest brain, but it describes the spin of the system, the intrinsic spin. Roger mentioned that the dependence of M on position just gets up the skewing of the momentum of a C number, and that goes out on this formula. So this is independent of position. The intrinsic property of the Pauli. Another thing which people don't usually talk about, though Lane Houston has in connection with variable momentum moments, and in his thesis, has talked about this position vector, which in ordinary niche classical theory, these two terms are the same. In classical theory, it boils down to the thing which basically labels where your system is, particularly its spinless. It satisfies an identity that if you contract it with p is 0. It doesn't satisfy that identity here, but it's x dot p is equal to 3i h slash 0.2. Just a peculiar identity. That thing is going to be quite useful, but even more useful, I just take a linear combination of this thing with this, the complex coefficient, and call it y. Just remember that, because it's not very easy in the rest of the talk. With this U1 symmetry, I've defined that the actual notation I use for the U1 symmetry. So the real part of it is the dilation operator, and the imaginary part is this, what I call this actual U1 thing. Then using that lambda, let me just define this thing, which is the key ingredient of this presentation, or this thing in the next one. This is just a linear combination of y and this jump here, and it's just chosen in such a way, essentially, that z no longer satisfies any identity. X is a component of x times if the parallel to p is fixed by the identity x dot p is essentially 0 toward h of 1. But this one doesn't satisfy any such identity. It just satisfies the identity that z dot p is basically lambda. So you just the lambda feeds into the extra degree. Now the last thing we do, which is the most non-trivial, is this new operator R. R involves a special Cavour transformation, it's Q, and this rather powerfully constructed little jump here, which involves this Z. You have to write it in a simple form like this, you need to split it, because the indices will get screwed up. But this is the key ingredient. Okay, now you've done that, you get a nice appearance to the computational version. The computational that I write down now will be exactly equivalent to the original ones that I wrote down in resulting the structure of the conformal algebra. Completely equivalent. So, the conformal algebra plus the U1 symmetry give you the 16 degrees of freedom. Remind you, 16 degrees of freedom now are the Z, which has, because Z is complex, it's a, the y part of it has its I in it, so the real bit and the I bit. It's a complex four-vector operator. Then we also have the momentum, which is another four-vector operator. Complex four-vector 2 is 8 real degrees of freedom. 4 for the momentum, and another 4 for this vector, R, which is also the momentum. Okay, we're going to have a computation, which is a bit more pretty. Let me write down these ones first. We still have the momentum cubes itself, Plus, frankly, we find Z commuted with itself. Perhaps more surprisingly, Z commuted with P is the canonical commutation relation. The non-trivial commutators is basically the next lot. Z commuted with Z bar is still not very difficult. Z and P, Z bar, basically. Z commuted with R gives you that R and P. R commuted with R gives you R in respect to T, which is just a linear combination of Z and Z bar, and there's an imaginary cross of Z and Z bar, or a linear combination of the imaginary position. And the nice new thing about this is that the commutation relation of P with R is zero. And that's the key ingredient. Remember the commutation relation of Q with P. If you look back here, it's rather complicated. What I've done is chosen the definition of this vector R in terms of, by adding all these extra bits, such that these extra bits have exactly the same commutation relation to P as plus Q. In which case, when you subtract them, you get zero. So that's the key new ingredient. But now, what's the interpretation of this? Well, this means that this four vector R, which is the extra thing that you need to describe the system, apart from the complex position vector Z and the momentum of P, this vector R is intrinsic to the system. It's not something which depends on position. That's the meaning of this formula. So it's just as intrinsic as the intrinsic fit. Okay, but there's also something more I want to do about this, which comes in a second. And I just said here that if we're given P, Z, and R being these correct commutation relations, then you can also reconstruct the original operators that are stuck with. And they obey the correct commutation relation. Another thing about this vector R is that, so first of all, let's define the spin square. It's just given by the square of the color of the maxi spin vector divided by n squared. Then we have the following property. First of all, this extra U1 symmetry which I threw in, that's the Casimir operator, SU22. Now, what about the other Casimir operators? Well, take the component of the vector R in the direction of the momentum. So add on J squared, and you get the second Casimir operator. Next, take the component of the vector R in the T direction, which is just a combination of S and P, and you get the third Casimir operator. Finally, take the square of the vector R, add on a bit of modulo J squared, and you get a fourth Casimir operator. In the classical theory, R itself is a Casimir operator because H bar is zero.
These Casimir operators are U22.
Is basically U22 now, right? Basically, SU22 is a conformal group, third and T1 are making it U22. So you have four Casimir operators independent of U22. There are a lot of other things about the R operator. Let me just list a few. Firstly, it vanishes identically for a two-switch system. That means that basically once the two-switch system tells the property that once you specify that, I'll come back to this, is that once you specify the primary structure and their dilation structure, you've basically got everything. It automatically extends to the performance structure. Next thing is that if you look at classical free twister theory, h bar equals zero, it's a null vector. No longer vanishes. We'll come back to that question again. In the quantum free twister case, it's no longer a null vector, basically because things are no longer commute. But you have this following expression that this vector R is now depends on another spin operator, plus another jump, which comes in with the quantum mechanics here. And also, the R and R bar is commute. In fact, you can just list the commutation relations of the R. Just zip through them. R commutes with itself. Commutes with R bar, you get back to the T vector. Again, it's not station invariant, like the whole operator R was. It has a simple commutation relation that gives it a spinner, right handed, and left handed. Now, one crucial thing about this is that the spin is not conformally invariant. Spin squared, if you commute it with all your various generators, it's obviously primary invariant. It's also dilation invariant, but it's not invariant under these extra special conformal transmissions we use this hour. And in particular, it's been shown that in the three twister case, it is not performing there. In other words, if you take a three twister system and operate on it by conformal transformation, you can change its spin. An example of that basically was given by Lane. Essentially, you could get a scalar meson, a pseudo-scalar meson from a vector meson sum by conformal transformation. Let me just list what the three twister, what this R operator looks like for a three twister system. I said it was just a spinner operator, what a spinner is. When you just take your three twisters, the X one here just guarantees you've got one of them there, another one there, and a third one there. Skew them together, skew them also with a four-dimensional twister skewing operator, and hit it with the infinity twister, and that gives you the spectral arm. But the important point about that is that this way you can see that what the meaning of this operator is, at least in this context. Basically, it measures the deviation of the twister system from being a purely local quantum system. In the two-twister theory, remember it vanished. And that reflects the fact that joining any two twisters, there's a line in twister space, and a line in twister space reflects locality in Minkowski space. But here, if these three twisters are not linearly independent, the spinner doesn't vanish. Only if they're linearly dependent, which is when the three twisters are lined up in a non-generic position, will you get the vanishing in this thing. So interpret that as meaning that the system is inherently non-local. Now there's also a basic result in this business, which is the following. I said it rather loosely again. Remember I said the dilations were a bit of a problem. The reason is because if you have a system of non-zero mass and operate on a point of dilation, you just scale the mass. So the mass could take arbitrary values. A remarkable fact of this algebra, conformal algebra, is that if you just omit the dilations from that algebra and just look at the vector of RP and MAB together with the G1 bit, which you believe in or put out as you like, the whole algebra closes. This is a non-trivial result. The curious thing about it is that it's just not a linear algebra. I don't know if that's obvious. It is if you look at one of these formulas. Let me just remind you of that.
Joe?
Yeah?
Surely the other thing will disappear either, because you have products of generators.
I can't hear what you're saying.
The other thing you wrote was not in the algebra either, because it had products of generators on the right-hand side.
That's basically what I was just about to say.
Sorry.
The other thing is exactly what I'm talking about. The sort of commutation relations you get a quadratic in a thing that you're commuting. For that reason, it isn't in the algebra. It could be regarded. But to be more precise, to be a bit more fancy about this, if you look at the enveloping algebra of the conformal group, plus or minus U1, depending on what you like, this enveloping algebra contains, the enveloping algebra has on it a commutator given by the Poisson bracket in the classical theory or given by the commutator of just operators in quantum theory. It has that structure on it. And what I'm just saying is that there exists a sub-algebra of this which contains everything that you want apart from the dilation. So in other words, what you can do is just do conformal particle theory, just pretending that the dilations are in there, and throw them out and you're going to come to life. Now, this is basically the philosophy. Whether this actually stands up is another matter. Because it turns out in the twister theory, we do seem to, it's rather hard actually just to throw out, although algebraic you can throw them out. In actual, when you get down to details, it's not so easy. Now, the point is that this is a counterexample in spirit to something whose name I don't have time to look up. I don't know how to say that. It's a rapidity. It's rather a neat theorem that you can't sort of embed a concrete group in a bigger structure. Lucy stated, because you would then get a continuous mass spectrum. The point is, if you don't worry about the bigger structure representing a making a Lie algebra, then that theorem doesn't apply. So it's only a kind of example in the spirit, because that's what we've got. It's similar to the answer right there. But the axioms of the theorem are not satisfied. They're not saying we're really wrong. It's just a spiritual thing. At least in my opinion.